Yes.
Yeah. Only water.
Okay. All right.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this second session of the week on rate-regulated activities. The purpose of this session is to focus on agenda papers 9 through 9E, which is a package of materials covering pretty much all of the main aspects of the model. As we mentioned in the cover paper, paper 9, we do have some quite discrete items to bring back based on the feedback that we had in May meeting when we had the education session, plus a couple of other things that we've carried across from previous meetings, and we highlight those in paper 9. But we're hoping that the package of materials that we've got today covers sufficient of the materials that we think that we need to go to the drafting stage for an exposure draft. So in agenda paper 9, we do have a question that we'd like to come back to at the end of the meeting, once you've had chance to consider each of the individual papers, where we will ask a general question: do you think we've got enough, subject to the items that we've highlighted, to come back at a subsequent meeting to ask for permission to begin the balloting process for an exposure draft rather than for a discussion paper. So that's just a highlight. That's what we're going to come back to. The team here, both Mariella and Neil and myself, are going to take the lead on different papers, but we will start with paper 9A on the general principles, so I'll hand that over to Mariella.
Thank you, Jane. Agenda paper 9A is based on agenda paper 9A discussed with you last month, and the purpose of this paper is first to provide with clarification on the meaning of goods or services supplied. This is now addressed in paragraphs 27 to 28, and we'd like to note that this clarification neither changes the principles nor the expected outcomes of the model. And second, the purpose of this paper is also to provide further analysis on the unit of account in response to concerns expressed by some board members last month about the model having, for measurement purposes, a unit of account that in some instances is different than the individual timing differences. We note that the conceptual framework acknowledges that different units of account might be appropriate for different purposes, and so for the reasons explained in paragraph 42 of Agenda 9A, we recommend the model does not include a general statement that the unit of account is the individual timing differences. And this leads us to the first question that we have after paragraph 43. So do board members agree with the staff's recommendation that the board does not include in the model a general statement that the unit of account is the individual timing differences?
Okay, sure.
Maybe I could ask you a question. So I'm not sure whether I agree or not, because I'm not certain what the document then says on unit of account and what it means. So if all that you're saying here is that we're not saying that it has to be every single timing difference has to be sort of tracked and accounted for as a separate item, but rather, for example, when we look at the recognition and measurement, it might be appropriate to look at related timing differences and to think about them, then I think I agree with you. But I think we need to be careful not to imply that, for example, if I had two timing differences that were moving in different directions and there were different things that might drive your estimations of whether one might occur or the other, that we're not saying, don't worry about that, you can look at it collectively. And I'm sort of presuming that's not what you mean, but I'm not sure how extreme the effect is of what you're saying here. So I wasn't clear exactly what's in the document. If we don't say it's individual, what are we saying?
Perhaps you want to answer that question now.
Well, we think that when we discussed with the board the unit of account of the model, at that time it was in February last year, and it was convenient to relate those individual timing differences We discussed this as when we were discussing whether those individual timing differences that were the incremental rights and obligations fulfilled the definition of assets and liabilities. And that was at that time, we had not discussed recognition and measurement. And what the conceptual framework says is that we need to consider the unit of account when discussing recognition and measurement. So we acknowledge that decision that we took in February might have been a bit premature because we have not discussed recognition and measurement. But that was a useful decision for us to conclude that those incremental rights and obligations fulfill the definitions. Now when we have moved on and as we have developed the model, we have encountered, for example, when discussing how would an entity estimate future cash flows, we said that an entity would be using the most likely amount or the expected value method, and it would do so considering particular timing differences or group of timing differences depending on which prediction of the ultimate cash flow would be the best. So what we think is that when the board had to develop the requirements as the project moved forward, the board has decided what was the unit of account that was appropriate for that specific circumstance. And then that's why when thinking of what would it imply to state that the unit of account is individual timing differences, we think that it would imply that we define what is individual timing difference, and we think that that might be a complex exercise. So for that reason, then, we are concluding that we do not necessarily need that the model explicitly states what is the unit of account because we have the board has decided when appropriate and in specific circumstances what was the unit of account.
Mary?
I have two things in this area in terms of the changes. One is paragraph 28, the expanded discussion of goods or services supplied. I think this is the right way to view things, broader rather than narrowly. Only things you can touch or see something delivered. But I think we'll have to think about this. We don't bring out in this paper what the implications of that broader one are. So I think it's right, but I think we haven't then gone on to say, therefore, it means this rather than that in terms of determining whether or not you have an adjustment. And that's not a shortfall. I think it will come in drafting the document rather than the paper. Yeah. But going back to the issue we were just discussing about the unit of account, I do not agree with the staff's recommendation. While I agree that we have moved away from timing differences as the item, and I think if I rephrase this question to say, do not include a general statement that the unit of account is the individual adjustment, then I don't agree with that part of it. The reason I don't agree is, first, as you said, when we discussed it early last year, some of the questions we were asking is, are you accounting for the agreement as a whole, which would almost be an intangible asset? The second is, are you accounting, and we said no, are you accounting for the net change in the period? Mm. And we said no, it's the individual items and it's that traceability to the activities performed in the period and the resulting incremental right or incremental obligation that is what satisfies the definition. So I think that is the unit of account. And while we might group individual items in other sections, I think it doesn't change what the item that we're focusing on, which is the individual rights and obligations. And in terms of especially the measurement, I mean, I think hold some of the comments on measurement until we get to those papers. But one of the things we've seen in IFRS 17, and this time I've got my standard number right as opposed to in the last discussion, with insurance is how once you put things in and say it isn't the individual items anymore, it's the group, how much that has ramifications going forward that limit traceability between the amount of an individual item and either truing it up or de-recognizing it when, let's say, a performance obligation has been satisfied. And I think our conclusion about meeting the conceptual framework definition of an asset and liability was the traceability between, because I did X in the period, I have this right or obligation. So I'm troubled with not saying that the unit of account, and maybe we just address it as we go through each section, that the unit of account, at least for recognition, is the individual adjustment. And that doesn't say there shall be no grouping in terms of the way we say in the revenue contract that you may look at basically aggregations of individual contracts, but that doesn't change the unit of account.
So if I can make a couple of comments on that. First of all, I agree with you totally that when the unit of account isn't the whole contract. We've said that we're accounting for a subset of the rights and obligations that arise because you've delivered goods and services in this period or because customers were paid before you've delivered the goods and services. But they are a set of rights and obligations, and the question is how far do we drill down to that in individual level, into individual components. It's a different situation from IFRS 17 because there we're talking about separate contracts and to what extent do we aggregate separate contracts. Here we're talking about how much do we disaggregate the package of rights and obligations that are created by a single regulatory agreement. The board has come across various places where it's felt it's necessary within this package, within this model, to specify how much we drill down. So, for example, we've got some of the recognition and measurement discussions. We've got some of the presentation and disclosure discussions as well, and I take the point that some of those might be aggregation of individual units of account, depending on how you describe the units of account. I think the difficulty with trying to specify the units of account as a general requirement is, first of all, if we're very insistent on saying we have to account for the individual item, let's call it, then people are going to think it's going to be really important to drill down to that individual item. But then secondly, we're going to need to define what we mean by that. I don't think we necessarily know what we mean exactly by an individual timing difference or by an individual adjustment. I think there are various ways you could look at it. And it may not matter very much because I think we specified in the instances where it matters what level of aggregation we're thinking of. And the thing that worries me is if we then say it's really important that we drill down to a particular level but we haven't identified that particular level, then we're going to make the whole model seem much more complex than it needs to be.
But this just seems at odds to me with the discussion that we had, including with our consultative group that looked at the question of traceability, where they said, no, we have to keep, for reporting to the regulator, we have to keep records by adjustment, whether it's input, input prices, volume sold, et cetera. So we can tell you, don't worry, we can tell you for each item what
But that's why we don't need to specify, because it's the regulatory agreement that's saying, yes, you're going to be compensated for delivering this thing, but you're not going to be delivered until, you're not going to be compensated until some future period. So for that mechanism to work, you have to know which parts you're not allowed to bill this period and which parts you are going to be allowed to bill next year. So that's already a given in the schema we're set up with. But then we don't need to drill down within that to try and further identify individual items for some accounting purpose.
I think if maybe I could just add, one of the things that did come out of the consultative group that we see is that there is sometimes traceability of individual items up to the point where they're assessed and approved for carry forward into the rate, but then they will get crushed down into a single item. So, for example, you may have to look at your input costs to the goods that you're supplying, and there may be variances on different types of inputs, so, different types of fuel that you use or different types of raw materials. So you're tracking those, but then because, as Sue mentioned, they're all treated in an identical way by the regulator, sometimes they're then pressed into a package, and these are all variants, just input cost variances, and so they'll be looked at as a single package. And then, in some cases, they're not carried forward as individual input variances for the different types of raw material. They just get crushed into one single line item to carry forward through the accounts because they're all treated identically in terms of the rate adjustment going through. So I think part of the question is then, what do we mean by these individual differences? If they start off as 10 different raw material types,
but then end up as one single input variance, are we still keeping the 10 different types, or are we happy to crush it down into one item?
I remain unconvinced, but I think we should move on.
Daryl?
I think I probably struggled a little bit with the point Mary's raised, largely because I was trying to understand what the implications are of it. And listening to the way you've described it, it still sounds like it is maybe the individual triggering mechanism that creates the recognition at the first instance, and that you'll probably assess that for probability and other things as a single one. And what happens is you almost immediately start to group them up and group them up and group them up through the process. And some of the decisions you'll take later today are... will be about that as well. So I think it's probably, it is as much as anything just an understanding perspective, but it does feel like you are saying the individual does matter at least at the point. Because that's what gives rise to it in the first place. The other question I wanted to ask about was just to make sure I understood what the implications were of the definition in paragraph 28, and specifically 28b little 2. So we're defining a good and service as standing ready.
Right.
And that seemed to suggest to me that we could actually say that we have triggered a difference just by being there, mm-hmm. not actually doing something.
Yeah.
Now, I assume what we actually mean there is you have to have done something. You have to have done the repair or the... It's not the standing ready so much as the doing the repair.
Yes. So the clarification in paragraph 28 is triggered by the question of some board members last month. When they were seen, they wanted to understand better what we were meaning by goods or services supplied, because they feared that we could have incurred allowable expenses when satisfying requirements in the regulatory agreement that the regulator allows us to pass through the rate. But if we had a very narrow description of goods or services supplied, because those expenses incurred might have been incurred in activities that are indirectly to the supply of goods and services, then they could be scoped out, and therefore you would not be accounting for regulatory assets that you would have to account for. So this is basically a clarification to have a broader goods and services. They might be directly related to the supply of goods and services, but they might be also indirectly related, because they correspond to expenses incurred when carrying activities contemplated in the regulatory agreement. And yes, to your question, yes, you should have done something that...
Absolutely. Yes. So, I mean, just to confirm that, if I'm understanding correctly, if I struck the word standing ready and simply said repair damage to the network, that would still work.
Yeah.
And then I think you might want to think about striking it out, because it just feels like a confusing term.
All right, thank you.
And that's a lightning phrase in our world. Yes.
Gary?
Yes, Tim. I have the exact same concerns as the prior speakers about unit of account. I don't know what harm it is to recommend in an ED the individual timing difference is the unit of account. You can always back off from it later on if input gets developed from it. And so I sort of remain unconvinced, you know, that we should drop it. It wasn't all that well developed in here. I think you make the comment in paragraph 42. Furthermore, we're not defined what is meant by individual timing difference, and we don't believe it would be useful or easy to do so. I submit that the preparers who live in this world, they know exactly what it is. And so the people who need to know, in fact, do know on it. So I would fine on aggregating similar timing differences that got the same economic drivers that end up affecting one billing, and I would argue that is the timing difference. It's not the details behind it. I'm not asking to go back and do more work, you know, on it and bring it back. I just have to disagree with where we are. I think we spent a lot of time on the unit of account being the individual difference over the last 18 months, and in many other projects we grapple long and hard about what is the unit of account, and I think we've already done that successfully here. Can always retreat from it, you know, a year from now after we get feedback.
Mm-hmm. Amaro.
Thanks. Well, thank you for the paper. I came to the meeting agreeing with staff, because my understanding was, in summary, exactly the same as Sue's had, but when Sue's asked the question, I started to think, well, I might be reading this easy, maybe because I've been quite involved in this. So, but if someone asks if this is the meaning of the unit of why we are proposing to drop the unit of accounting, the of account, as you stress in paragraph 42, that our perception that including this general statement would cause confusion and uncertainty. And so I started rethinking my view. Then heard the previous ones, and I guess I would stress Gary's wise comment to me is that how harmful it could eventually be if we put this in a consultation document and leave the interested parties to provide us the feedback in order to understand. Our objective is actually to get the model right in a simple way and capture these rights and obligations. So I think if this is my perception, keep the unit of account as we decided before, going to the consultation document wouldn't get us or lead us to do additional work. I would then keep it.
On the goods and services issue, I support what you have included there, subject to the changes in wording that Daryl has highlighted. But I would also, I would also wish that how we get to this broad notion is arrived at in the basis for conclusions. And I think it has a lot to do with this being a supplement to IFRS 15. Because otherwise you would be describing, you could be seen describing a delivery to oneself as a profit recognition activity. And I think that's not what we are doing.
Okay, shall we go to a vote? Who can support the staff's recommendation on the unit of account?
Three.
We move on.
So the next paper in the package is paper 9B, which is looking at scope, definitions of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, recognition and derecognition. The bulk of this paper has been carried forward from the education session in May. The biggest change that's highlighted here is in the May meeting, we had a discussion about fines that are imposed on the entity where it may not be quite so clear that the action causing the fine is related to goods and services supplied during the period. And the discussion, we've touched on it a couple of times already, was to make sure that the definition of goods and services supplied was sufficiently broad to capture these types of fines that are then going to be paid by a deduction from determining the rate. And this is one of the implications. A couple of people have said in paper 9A it wasn't clear what some of the implications might be, and this is one of them highlighted in paper 9B, that the assumption is that if the regulator is putting things through the rate, then there is a connection to the goods and services supplied, and we'll fall back to if it would be recognised as an expense under IFRS during this period, it relates to goods and services supplied during this period. If it was an item that would be recognised as an asset to carry forward to a future period, it would be goods and services in a future period. But as it's to do with fines, then it would be captured as goods and services supplied during the period is the action that's triggered the fine. So that's the main change in this paper. There is a package of questions at the end of the paper, but I suggest that we just open the floor to comments on the whole paper and then take the package of questions at the end.
Mary?
Broadly in agreement with the staff proposals and the questions. I just, and I apologize, I didn't have a chance to go back and look this up myself. I thought at one point we were, just reflecting on scope generally, we were talking about one of the things that makes rate regulation more than just price regulation is the fact that obligations are imposed on the rate-regulated entity, and we don't seem to have a discussion of the obligations imposed in this paper. And is that, can you just remind me of whether that disappeared inadvertently or deliberately and what the thinking was, if it's deliberate?
It was deliberate, but it's a long time ago. It was back in February 2018, yeah. March 2018, when we did the scope recognition, or sorry, the scope definition. Yeah. And at that time, we said that the performance obligations and what it was that the entity had to do in exchange for what we're now calling the total allowed compensation built in those obligations. So the pricing that's set is based on the goods and services that are being required to be supplied.
I don't want to start redrafting on the fly in any way, but I think... well, give me a discount for aging memory and not recalling everything, but it wouldn't have been obvious to me that the language we have in here has that implicit requirement for obligations. So I don't want to start suggesting that you redraft the scope, but I think we have to bring that out because I think there is just this basic question of what's the difference between tough price regulation and rate-regulated activities, and that'll matter, for example, when we get to, well, no. I don't know that it will, but I think it'll help distinguishing situations and not having panic that this is going to be too broadly applicable.
Yeah.
So bringing that out is, I think, important.
I think one of the areas there that also we touched on in discussions were about bonuses, bonuses and penalties if you haven't delivered to a specified performance target. So that's another area that we can use to tease that point out. Thanks, Mary.
Doc.
Thank you. Slightly more general question about the scope. I read the new definition, and I think this is a significant improvement, and everything is clearer than before. I appreciate that. But then here comes other concern. I think I have seen the similar binding contract long time before in my previous life in the area of contract. Of a wholesaler with the manufacturer. So in the area of the manufacturer has a strong controlling power when only that manufacturer can produce specific items like industrial parts or some steel component, then they have strong power to control the market. And then they decide retail price or the sales price to retailer, and then their production price is stable, and they use the wholesaler as a kind of shock absorber. Then the binding contract between wholesaler and the manufacturer looks almost similar to the point you have raised. So the question is, this is rate-regulated activities proposal, and then we define who the regulators are. That's fine. However, my question is there any reason to single out the regulator? Because if we have this such a clear definition of what's the implication we need to add on top of IFRS 15, then no matter who is all about, those who meet these criteria could recognize some asset and liability. So then what is the difference between rate regulator and the manufacturer who has a strong power to control the market?
I think in terms of that question, Tack, the first place I would look, you mentioned there's a contract between the two parties, so the first place I would look would be IFRS 15, so examining that contract very carefully. Again, without seeing a specific example, I would imagine that's the first place that most people would be taken to through the contractual agreement.
Yeah.
If, however, it didn't get you into 15 because it did look like
it was relying on the customers of the retailer, the retailer, and the prices that the retailer's customers were paying, then again we would need to look at the various factors that we've been looking at in this project to say whether that that really is a sufficiently binding agreement that's going to work, giving those rights and obligations. And if it is, I'm not sure why we would want to exclude if it's giving the same sorts of rights and obligations. So we haven't specified who the regulator is, but I think, you know, as long as the rights and obligations are there in the contract, or the binding terms are there.
But the reason why I'm raising this question is because you are saying that the binding entity and the regulator. And the regulator is defined in the IFRS 14 currently. If we bring the same definition, then that says authorized body that is empowered by statute or regulation to establish the rate. Blah blah blah. So, definition sounds like governmental body, or the organization who delegated the power of governing or kind of legal power. But if I look at the binding contract, the binding contract itself is a legally binding power, even within the private entities. So then, my question is, as you said, if binding contract meets almost exactly this definition, can we apply this standard? Or if you are not a regulator defined in IFRS 14, you cannot apply it. That is what I was confused.
Our focus was regulated.
Yeah.
I think it's a short answer. Yeah.
Short answer is regulated. So that means this is industry-specific standard. And first we define who the regulator is. And only for the regulator we provide this definition. Is my understanding correct?
May I try? Consider my understanding of what we are talking here. We because reading only this piece, we can eventually reach strange conclusions. Mm. So we are talking about a tripartite scheme where you provide services in advance, but you can't charge. Mm. So to me, we have to consider what happened during the previous period that led to rights and obligations. This is one thing. With regards to the company that provides goods and services and their customers. So then comes the regulator, and the regulatory agreement needs to be a binding agreement in order to form the tripartite scheme. Mm. So I think the way it's described, it's appropriate to capture when we have this holistic relationship between a company providing services and goods and services to customers that are not directly related to a third party who is the regulator, and then we can frame it properly.
Okay. Just quickly, the first point you raised, so whether or not you provided service but have not charged.
Yeah.
So these kind of things happens even between the private entities.
Yeah.
But your point is you need three people.
Yeah.
Not only just two.
Yeah, exactly.
And the third people is the regulator.
Yeah.
That is the uniqueness of this.
Exactly.
And even if the contract between the two parties, the binding and the exactly same mechanism, we cannot apply this standard.
In principle,
okay. Thank you.
Okay. Listen, we have still a lot of paper, so I would like to ask everybody to be as brief as possible. Tom?
I have a quick question. I'd like this paper a lot, and I like the new definition. Just, is it in any way dependent on what you had said about unit of account in the last paper? Like, does that being voted down cause any grief in applying all this?
You say no.
I was trying to think of why I would not say no. I think, again, as we said, it's that traceability and it's the generation, so no.
So we're okay?
We're okay.
Okay, thanks.
Just want to quickly check paragraph 21, inside the box 19 through 21, where you're talking about the fines, and the fines are not paid, they go through the rate adjustment. Just that last sentence, you're talking about an obligation to pay such fines, but the way you're setting this up, there isn't an obligation to pay the fines. We're not recognising an obligation, it goes through the rate. Am I understanding that correctly?
We would be recognising the obligation in terms of a liability because it's not going to go through the rates until a later period.
So there is an obligation?
There is an obligation.
Regulatory liability to reduce the rate in future. Okay. The reason is the fine.
Is the fine. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay. Can we vote on question one, who supports the staff recommendation?
14.
Okay.
Yes. This paper is also based on a paper that we discussed last month and addresses three aspects of the measurement requirements in the model that are described in paragraph 3 of the paper. I'll be now covering the first of these three matters, which is the measurement of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities arising from items treated as CAPEX and from items treated as OPEX. Neil will then address the adequacy assessment of the regulatory interest rate, which is covered in 9D, and then we will then come back to the last two matters in this paragraph 3. So to start with the first matter covered in this paper, in December last year, we recommended two different measurement approaches for OPEX and CAPEX. For OPEX, the board tentatively decided that the measurement would include all of the estimated cash flows arising from regulatory assets, including cash flows relating to regulatory interest or return, and then the approach would use the regulatory interest or return as a discount rate, except in limited circumstances. And that measurement approach for OPEX was consistent with former decisions made by the board in May and July 2018, and it was strongly supported by the board in December. For CAPEX, the board tentatively decided that an entity would include only the estimated future cash flows arising from the original timing difference and would discount them at a rate of 0%. And the board had mixed views on that measurement approach for CAPEX. In response to these concerns, we are now asking the board to consider using the same approach for both OPEX and CAPEX, which is the approach that we discussed last month. And further analysis of the effects of applying this approach is discussed in 9D. But before moving to that paper, to 9D, we would like to ask you whether you would have any comments up to paragraph 29 of 9C.
Twenty-nine
as well, because it's the estimating cash flows, and nothing has changed since May.
So. You are not going to the question, not yet. Okay, sorry.
Daryl,
you throw me a little bit on the 29, so I'm now worried I'm going to ask a really stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. paragraph 20.
Yes.
Was sort of the key paragraph in this section. Okay. It picks up to a certain extent from what I think was in paragraph 16 in talking about the,
yes.
The one thing that is lost between 16 and 20 is the little bit that talks about unless there's clear evidence that the excess relates to.
Yes, that's why in my script I said, except of limited circumstances, yes, which are covered in 9D paper. Yes, you're right, yeah.
Mary?
A couple things that I think we need to think about for later rather than a problem with what's here. I think, first of all, the paper, I did a count and got a dozen uses of the word typically in this document, and we don't say what happens if it isn't the typical fact pattern. My assumption in my voting is going to be based on the assumption that you're just trying to say, for context, this is what we see, but it isn't meant as an expression of conditionality, as in, if you don't have the typical fact pattern, you might have to do something different. Okay, but I think we have to be careful about the drafting, and following on from that point about drafting, we've used a variety of vocabulary, consider, estimate, identify, da-da-da, in terms of, I think, when we're trying to say estimate the cash flows. So being disciplined about that. Now, something we don't discuss in here, when you're talking in paragraph 7, you're pointing out that what a regulator may consider as the regulatory asset base is likely to be, I'll make up a number, 30%, what we call the incremental, the overlay adjustments. But the bulk of it may be my IFRS measure of PP&E, for example. And we don't explain how you think about the return on regulatory asset base for the portion that is the IFRS measure, when you recognize that. And I think we have to, don't try and do it now, don't try and explain it now, but I think we have to lay that out because that's going to be a big piece of the return that the entity recognizes. And if it's not related, if it's a return that's not on an adjustment, how does it fit into the model is the question.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we move on to paper 9D, I understand.
Sorry, one quick question.
John, sure.
Yeah, I didn't ask that recommendation.
The question is going to be asked later. What am I confused now?
The paper 9D sort of goes through the implications of looking at this as one single measurement approach for all of these bits. So we felt it was appropriate to go through paper 9D to check the questions.
Come back.
Going to come back.
We'll
come
you can back still to ask. You can still ask Nancy.
Yeah, just I answer this very simple, quick question.
Confuse the board. Jungle.
Okay. Yeah, so 9C is correct. Okay. I agree with just one simple measurement approach for both the operating and their capital RCB base transactions. But just a quick check. We need any kind of additional simplification for those utilities companies, because last December we have considered some kind of difficulties in practice. Those companies might have some problems. We need just force them to use just one single method. So at that time there are so many transactions really.
I think that's 9D and the gap year issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, then maybe please answer then at that time. Okay. All right, great.
And Zhao?
Just clarify one thing. 9C about regulatory risk. I appreciate that we including that risk when estimating future cash flows. One question is that not only regulatory risk and also other demand risk, customer credit risk, all those risks sometimes may be a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. So whether we are required company to disclose those relevant information in the notes to let the user know that, okay, maybe the risk is very higher, you should know that there are a lot of uncertainty in the future cash flows. So this is the first question. Second question is that sometimes regulatory risk may be very high. So maybe the rate regulation agreement cannot be met, or the scope, even the scope will be excluded. So I noticed paper 9, in the future you are going to adjust so-called uncertainty caused by renewal clauses in the regulatory agreement. So this is, I think, one of the factors will be considered. But I'm thinking that maybe not only limited to the renewal clauses, maybe others uncertainty, because it seems that regulatory risk much broader than that uncertainty caused by renewal clauses. So I want to make sure that whether that issue will be addressed, not only the measurement part, but also will be addressed at the recognition criteria part in the future.
Back in November, when we discussed disclosure requirements, we discussed one specific disclosure requirement dealing with the effect of risks in those regulatory items, regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, specifically an explanation of how the future recovery of regulatory assets or the future fulfillment of regulatory liability is affected by risks and uncertainty. So we did have this disclosure requirement back in November, yes.
Councilor Raza.
Well, my comment was also about regulatory risk and more particularly what is in paragraph 26. So may, or at least my understanding, if either 26A or 26B would verify, I would think that the entity, I mean, that the, this agreement is outside of the scope. It would no longer be what is a binding agreement. But, you know, if you have a political power to just not meet your obligations, then I think the agreement is not binding anymore. So I would want this to be removed and eventually move to supporting guidance or whatever for the scope and what the binding agreement is. Okay. Because that's getting into, in my view, much too much. I mean, to me, that's not what I understood. Okay. I 27, I think we had included that, but not 26.
I think this is the level of development, stability, predictability, degree of independence, and risk of politically motivated interventions. These are risks that are typically, and forgive me, Mary, for typically, but they are typically understood as related to regulatory risk. But you are right. So depending on the level of this risk, you could actually be threatening the binding agreement, per se, the feature of the agreement being binding. And then we might actually then have this closer to what we understand also by binding in the guidance or in the basis. So I understand what you're saying. And yes, that could threaten the binding feature of the agreement. You're right.
It's important to me because I agreed with the scope basically on that basis. And I'm going to support the measurement requirements, providing that this is not reflected in measurement, but it's really you're in or you're out. So it's important.
Okay.
Move on to paper 90 now. Paper 90 is a new paper. It seeks to respond to some of the feedback we received at the previous meeting in May regarding the selection of the discount rate to use in applying the measurement principles. So the first section of the paper deals with the practical expedient that was proposed by staff in May 2019, which would have alleviated the need for discounting where the time value of money and the risks inherent in the cash flows were determined not to be significant. Now, the board raised some concerns over how this expedient might be applied in practice and questioned whether this principle and some of the other measurement principles related to the discount rate could be further simplified. Some of the specific concerns were around the interaction of this requirement with the subsequent adequacy assessment and how the practical expedient might be designed and any materiality considerations that would be necessary in applying it. So staff have gone away and reconsidered the possible expedient and believe it may introduce unnecessary complexity into the model and may impose costs to entities which would outweigh any potential benefits from applying the expedient. So it's our recommendation that the significance test and the associated practical expedient not be carried forward into the exposure draft for the model. And I'd like to pause there for the first question. So does the board agree with the staff's recommendation not to include in the model a separate step that requires an entity to assess whether the effects of the time value of money and risks inherent in the cash flows are significant and be a practical expedient that would avoid the need for discounting if the effects of time and risks were not significant?
think I can support what you propose, but I would like the discussion to take place because I would really wish to have the feedback from constituents about whether this simplifies or whether this, in fact, makes the standard more complex. I agree it's a better reflection of the economics, but I'm not sure that it really reaches a good understandability. I mean, a good, let's call it cost-benefit, but I'm not sure that the users with this supplementary accounting are looking into this level of detail, in other words. And I wonder whether this is a simplification or making it more complex for entities, because it moves them away from just relying on their set of data that are provided for the regulator. So every step that moves them away from this already available data, to me, would be a further complexity. So I'm happy to go with the proposal on the basis that technically it's better, but I would like this to be gauged in the consultation with proper feedback being called on.
Jan Chow.
Just a clarification. You know, in my understanding, actually, we are not develop a proposal to incorporate the practical experience. Yeah. But the question 1B, it seems that if those effects of time and risk were not significant, that there was still practical experience available for them, for companies?
Is not to include.
Not to include A or B.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Problem solved. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Just let me help me understand. Having a practical expedient does not necessarily mean that we are imposing another layer of assessment. Because if you don't apply practical expedient, you don't really assess. So therefore, I couldn't really understand the logic you made in the paragraph 15, because it's simply practical expedient. It does not really impose them to do this process. So I echo with what the Francois said. Theoretically, we can make it simpler. But in the end, it may cause more trouble to the constituents. Then we need to reconsider. So we have to raise it, like Francois suggested.
I think one of the issues, Tacking, it was brought out in the May meeting, that if people choose immediately not to worry about going through the practical expedient, you're right, there's nothing for them to do. But if people wanted to use the practical expedient, they would have to go through the calculation of identifying what is significant, what's not significant. The practical expedient, from our point of view, then we would need to say, well, how long a period would it go through to allow them to assess it's not significant? So we've already, Neil's going to come on to talk about the adequacy test, and is the compensation adequate? And I think as part and parcel of the thought process there, it will lead into an assessment of, well, are the effects of the time going to be material, and then people can drop into their normal materiality mindset without having to go through a specific process to get there, which they might need to do on top of the adequacy test as well.
Mary?
I was just going to say, I found it hard to look at one in isolation because although it looks like a big structural change, in many ways we're just saying what follows in the next section is another way of skinning that same cat. So I almost would say maybe don't vote on one, because I think what the staff is saying is we found another way to attack this issue. Do you want to attack this issue about discounting with the approach that follows or a variant thereof, tipping my hand a bit, rather than the way we had structured it before? So I would almost say just move on from question one.
Let's just vote on it and quickly. Changwu.
Yes, so on the practical experience, everything's okay. One, that practical experience, can we introduce that 1-year rule? In the case of estimation variances, they might be happy. They might happen in many cases with estimation variance timing differences.
I think that was one of the concerns that was raised at the last meeting, that it would be tough to define a kind of bright line timing difference, because what we've seen in a lot of the regulatory agreements is even the shorter term differences would be recovered in 2 years from the date they were incurred, and it would be really facts and circumstances dependent.
We'd have to give such a long period for it to be of any use that it really would strain credibility.
I understand. We can give the decision to those companies if we just give us a 1 year rule like IFRS 15, you know. Maybe if they are not, if they need at least the 2 or 3 years, then it's okay. They don't have to have this kind of practical experience. But in the case of a timing difference about some kind of a, an estimation change, every year they are doing some kind of estimate change, there's one of a type of our timing difference. In that case, some cases might happen. They are just their rate adjustment in the next year, not the other, the year beyond that. So in that case, they can use this kind of participation.
Yeah, I mean, I think to Mary's point, the section we'll speak about next is hopefully a kind of a simplification of the adequacy assessment overall, such that it would be easier just to have this one coherent approach rather than having some timing differences that you didn't discount, some that you did, and I think the staff's thoughts were limiting it to 1 year wouldn't be enough to make a big enough difference for most entities applying the model, and once you start going beyond that period, it will gradually start to become material. Right?
Okay.
Can we vote on question number one, who supports self-recommendation?
13.
Moving on to the next section of the paper, the adequacy assessment. This was another area that the board asked the staff to provide some further analysis on, specifically the process that an entity should follow to assess whether the rate of return provided by the regulatory agreement is adequate, while also minimizing the complexity of this assessment for entities. So to start with, to attempt to minimize the model's complexity, the proposed measurement principles have been developed around the concept of a rate of interest or return being provided by the regulatory agreement that is adequate rather than one that perfectly exactly compensates the entity for the effect of time and the uncertainty inherent in the cash flows. We feel this is a valid assumption to make in most cases, given that the regulatory agreement, one of the key objectives of the regulatory agreement is to protect the financial viability of the regulated entity such that it can continue to provide the regulated goods or services on a go-forward basis. So we would recommend starting from that point and then only requiring entities to assess whether there's any indicators that may not be the case. So any indicators contrary to that assumption. And we propose that an entity could go about that by seeking to understand the process that the regulator has gone through to come up with the rate applicable to each different time band of items within the regulatory agreement, so some of your shorter-term items, CapEx-type items, and so on. And where a valid expectation can be established that the rate for each of those time bands is adequate, the entity would proceed to use that rate in the measurement of regulatory assets or liabilities falling within those time bands and would simply recognize the interest or return earned over time. However, if there was any indicators, and we set out some indicators, potential indicators in paragraph 29 of the paper, if there was any indicators present that the rate of return being provided was potentially inadequate, then we would propose that an entity be required to go away and establish what the minimum adequate rate that would compensate it for the risks and the effect of time inherent in the cash flows would be. And where that minimum adequate rate was less than the rate being provided in the regulatory agreement, the entity would reach the conclusion that it's effectively had a partial disallowance imposed on it. It's not going to recover the full amount of the timing difference. And so it should account for or should measure that item using the minimum adequate rate to discount the item and recognize interest over time at that minimum adequate rate rather than the rate being provided in the regulatory agreement. If, however, after establishing the minimum adequate rate, the entity determined that the rate being provided was still in excess of the minimum rate, it would conclude that it was being adequately compensated and would continue as normal to use the rate provided in the regulatory agreement. So that brings us to the question at the end of that section, and we've broken it down into three parts. So does the board agree with the staff's recommendations that the model applies an indicator-based approach to assessing whether the regulatory interest rate or return rate is adequate and includes guidance on indicators to consider in making that assessment? The recommendation that the model specify that the minimum adequate rate is one that the entity would expect to receive for a stream of cash flows with the same timing and uncertainty as those of the regulatory asset. And C requires that initial and subsequent measurement using the minimum adequate rate when an entity concludes that the rate of interest or return provided by the regulatory agreement is inadequate.
Martin.
I agree with staff recommendation, and I think it's a good practical approach to make it really, as I said, operational and only in sectional cases when the indicators hit, then you have to do something, because I think to make that perfect is, I think, impossible, because to come up with the right rate for this kind of assets and liabilities is very, very difficult, and therefore I agree with the staff recommendation. Very practical, good approach.
Okay. Mary, do you think it's a practical solution?
No. But I think some of the things that Martin's pointed to, I agree with, which is I think we should – I agree with the fundamental approach that we're not trying to remeasure everything to the conceptually right issue. Because, and I agree with the point that the objective, if you look at paragraph 35B, is to assess the adequacy of the rate, not to remeasure the rate. So I think 35B is good, and I think 35C is good. My problem is with using an indicator rate. I think it's both the harsh words I scribbled down were unnecessary and inappropriate. The reason I think it's inappropriate is I don't know what understanding the regulator's process for setting a rate tells me about whether, from an IFRS perspective, the rate is considered adequate, especially, you know, Neil, you cited the commitment to financial viability as one of the key attributes. It's not required in the scope of the standard, and we don't know how every, you know, whether every regulator around the world where IFRSs are applied, how they're, you know, whether they're going to factor that in. They, you know, the regulated entity might not last long, yeah, but they still would technically fit within the model. And I think it's unnecessary, because I think when you go on and explain this notion of time bands, even if the unit of account is the individual adjustment, the adjustments are, you know, there aren't 200 time bands, I assume, but rather more like three. So if the, you know, I think you can make an assessment of the adequacy of the rate for a time band and then just say, you know, given the duration, has it been assessed there? So I don't think we need to go through all the pre-screening of understanding the model, seeing, you know, how they set the model, what the inputs are, and then looking for indicators that it might not be appropriate. I think it's just a matter of go proceed directly to the end game of saying, is the rate adequate for the time band? And if there are some that are outliers, pull them out and deal with them separately on the exception basis. Mm-hmm. So in terms of Martin's support, hoping to build a bridge with him, even if he's disappeared, I think it's right to say all we're trying to do is assess the adequacy of the rate. Yeah. We're not trying to recalculate it. And I think that's a big part of his, it's operational and practical. I just think we can skip the whole indicator step that's 35A, and replace it with assess the adequacy of the rate.
Yeah, I think that may be somewhat of a drafting point.
Than a drafting point, because it says you don't have a presumption. This would say if it's consistent with how the regulator sets it, it must be okay. And that's
not necessarily. It's we want to understand process the regulator has gone through to set it. So, for example, one of our short-term timing differences, input cost variance, we know that the regulatory agreement provides us with a corporate borrowing rate plus a small margin. And we determine that for the items within that time band, say they're 1 to 3 years, that corporate borrowing rate that they've selected plus that margin is going to be adequate to compensate us. Then for any regulatory assets or liabilities that we recognize within that time band, okay, we can just take that rate that we've determined to be adequate and apply it to the measurement.
Why don't we just say, what's the rate? Is it adequate? Rather than I have to understand first how they set it, that it's corporate rate plus X percentage, et cetera. Why don't we just say, I mean, unless you think you can make it once for the time band in all perpetuity, but I think
well,
given...
That was a potential. So if you understand that the rate applied to that category is the corporate borrowing rate for that year, and then you may not have to do the assessment next year or the year after. Like for each individual regulatory asset or liability that you're recognizing within that time band, if you make the assessment, for example, once per reporting period, then you could just take that rate in the measurement of all items, subtracting that rate within the time band.
I was still thinking with directly you could do it once, for a reporting period, rather than as each item got chucked into the bucket.
Yeah.
I don't think you need the whole understand the structure and look for indicators.
I think we're aiming for the
same. That's what I say, yeah.
But yeah, that's well, I'm that not was saying, the yeah. drafting comment. Yeah. I think we're trying to get to this same.
Well, I think it's a big difference. It's not just drafting in terms of whether you say you have to go through this process and use an indicator screen and have debates with your auditors about whether the indicators are present or not, whether the list is adequate. I think we can just cut out a whole step. So therefore, I think it's more than drafting. But I think it's aiming for the same objective of is the rate adequate.
Can I just check with the, because you mentioned a couple of times you don't think an indicator approach, but in paragraph 29, Neil's got some indicators set out, and I would have thought that those are still valid, even if you go straight to, let's look at a time value of money plus a return. We still need to think, well, what rate has been given? Is there something peculiar going on that's...
If I can, because I think I'm agreeing with Mary, I think it was the same point. I agree. 35B and C I'm very happy with. Those make absolute sense. There's no question. 35A and even the indicators feel like you could cover simply with Mary's words, is the rate adequate? And then we could have a discussion. I think this is one of those areas where we can say, look, one of the ways you think about it is to say, is my base rate fine? Yep. Then everything at that base rate by implication is fine. Is there a deviation from the base rate that I need to have a look at? But that seems like it's not an indicator approach so much as is the base rate. And I think the thing that really puzzled me or that I found confusing in terms of terminology was paragraph 20. Because it seemed like we were almost recommending to the entity how they would go about doing something, which is not really what we need to do in a standard. It felt like an odd sort of recommendation. So I think, to your point, I think it possibly is drafting, but I think it's the drafting question here is where does it go? I don't think this needs to be in the standard. I think we can say that we were comfortable that this is not an onerous requirement because here's one of the ways an entity could go about doing it, and that can be a basis-type comment rather than a in-the-standard type comment.
Sorry to interrupt. Could be seen as Mary's proposal. She agrees with the direction. That's my understanding, but she would prefer principles based, is the rate adequate? And eventually these indicators that you are proposing could be in the basis for conclusion as things, aspects that we thought when we were developing the principle to adequacy.
Gary? I actually rather like the indicator approach, but listening to the discussion, if the objective is to assess the adequacy, well, assessing the adequacy, I think how to do that can mean many different things to many different people. We've spent months on the discount rates and regulatory assets and liabilities. And to me, assessing could be mathematical assessing. We have all sorts of debates. What is the reference rate you look at? I would suggest then either we leave it at 35A, B, and C as written, or if we want to modify it to these discussions, say the objective is to assess that you've got a minimum adequate rate, you may achieve that by an indicator's approach. I mean, an indicator to me is easier than assessment. To me, assessment is a mathematical proof that it's, and it certainly will be interpreted and applied that way in some instances out there. And I think it's a lot easier said to be done. I think you kind of know it if you got a good rate, kind of know if you got a bad rate. Indicators should probably get you there most of the time.
Of an approach that means you don't have to do spreadsheets and maths to get through the first filter, given that in most cases we don't think people will end up having to use the number. So, you know, happy with tweaks, but I like the idea that you've got in here.
Ms. Maza.
Same as you.
Okay, let's take a vote, and I think the staff has some drafting suggestions that they will take on board. Given that, who can support the staff's recommendation?
12.
Moving on to the remainder of 9D, the next section of the paper deals with two clarifying matters, specifying how the staff envisaged the model's discounting principles would be applied in two scenarios. So the first scenario is the situation where the rate provided by the regulatory agreement may not be readily apparent and must be determined. This would be the case, for example, where there is a gap period before any interest or return are provided on the base. So staff proposed that in this scenario, an entity would need to determine the implicit rate of interest or return being provided by the regulatory agreement. And we provide a numerical example of that in the paper. And then going forwards, we would recognize the return over time at that implicit rate of return as determined, unless that implicit rate was determined to be inadequate, in which case we would establish the minimum adequate rate as discussed in the last section. The second scenario analyzed by staff is one where a regulator has decided to provide an additional bonus return. So this is the identifiable event or transaction we've referred to previously that an entity is to remain aware for in assessing whether the rate is adequate. In the paper, we provide an example of an additional 2% return being provided on the regulatory capital base for a specified period of time. And we detail how an entity may account for that particular scenario. So estimating the amount of additional cash flow that it would become entitled to as a result of the incremental return and recognizing that as a separate regulatory asset in the period it became entitled to that additional return. And so just pause quickly there if there's any comments or discussion on those sections of the paper.
Gary, Neil, help me out. I thought someplace in the past we had decided that the individual rate and individual timing differences, sometimes they're higher or lower than markets, looking at the entire time band, they're using a higher or lower rate to balance the time band out. How does this align with that?
Yeah, so the scenario we're envisaging here is expected to be encountered extremely infrequently in practice. This would be, instead of the regulator giving us a, call it a nominal value bonus to be included in the rates in a period of time, they've instead affected that bonus by increasing the rate of return we're able to earn on a particular base for a period of time. So in our assessment of the adequacy of the rate, if we become aware that we're being provided with a bonus by way of an incremental return, rather than recognizing any regulatory assets and liabilities in that time band at that higher amount, we should seek to identify and separately recognize the effect of that bonus, the same as we would for that nominal bonus amount by estimating the cash flow and discounting that back. Again, this is not something we've seen an example of in practice, but we just want to include it so that the model is robust in that regard.
If it doesn't exist in practice, I mean, there's probably a lot of things that don't exist in practice we could put in here. Do we, in the interest of keeping the document shorter where possible, do we really need it? I understand completeness,
yeah. You
know, but if we're not finding it any place in practice, do we need it? I mean, don't necessarily disagree with the answer. You just are explaining the answer to my question, but just challenging the general need.
Yeah.
All right, move on.
The next section of the paper deals specifically with regulatory liabilities. So in July 2018, the board tentatively decided to adopt the same measurement requirements for regulatory liabilities as for assets. And as we've continued to develop the model, staff have continued to consider whether any different or supplementary guidance may be necessary for regulatory liabilities. To date, we still see no reason to apply different requirements to the estimation of future cash flows from regulatory liabilities. Regarding discounting and simplifying the model, we propose taking an approach similar to regulatory assets, where for regulatory assets, we're looking for a rate that adequately compensates an entity rather than exactly compensates an entity. For regulatory liabilities, we'd also be looking for a rate that adequately charges an entity rather than exactly charges the entity for the time and uncertainty between origination and fulfillment of the liability. Now, we acknowledge in theory that an entity may be able to obtain a lower rate of financing for a specific liability of similar time and uncertainty as a regulatory liability that's been recognized using the rate that's or against the rate that's applicable in the regulatory agreement. However, we do not consider this to dictate a conclusion that a liability is onerous immediately and that a day one loss would arise. Rather, we feel that this must be viewed in the context of the broader regulatory agreement, where, again, rates are provided to provide an entity with a measure of return and profitability on a larger base, making it financially viable for the entity to fulfill its requirements, and that rates are applied to bases which may include a number of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities and should not be viewed in isolation just on one regulatory liability alone. So as a result, we feel that the selection of a discount rate for the measurement of regulatory liabilities should mirror the process applied for regulatory assets. That is, an entity should apply a rate equal to the rate provided by the regulatory agreement, except in the limited circumstances where the rate reflects the impact of an identifiable event or transaction, which should be recognized separately, as we discussed in the last section.
This sounds eminently reasonable or not?
Just a very quick point. I think paragraph 54 and 55 essentially emphasize that the main reason why we're comfortable with this outcome is because we believe it's rare. And in fact, if it was not rare, if this was a 50-50 chance that it could be an asset or liability, we would probably have come to a different conclusion. I think if we can just make sure we highlight that in the basis of conclusions of the ED so that we get feedback on it in those circumstances, if in fact it is not rare. And I think, as I say, it's a core assumption. I agree it's imminently reasonable if we assume this almost never happens. If we think it's regularly could be a liability and the WACC is the rate that they apply, then it seems to me I would often typically have concluded that it was a onerous type liability because of the rate. And so I think we just need to highlight that that was why we got to this conclusion.
Yeah.
All right.
We have a question there, just whether the board agree with the staff's recommendation for the measurement of regulatory liability.
14.
Excellent. 14. It was indeed eminently reasonable.
And then just a quick section at the end of that paper regarding changes in estimate. Again, we're not proposing any new guidance in this section against the previous tentative decisions of the board, which were to update the estimate of cash flows at each reporting date, but to keep the discount rate constant unless the regulatory agreement was to change the rate applicable to that regulatory asset or liability, in which case we would update both the cash flows and the discount rate. So again, we wouldn't propose any changes there, but linking it in with some of the earlier discussion, if that change in the discount rate caused the rate to no longer be adequate, we'd propose that entities would be required to go back and establish the minimum adequate rate and carry out the assessment that was discussed earlier in the paper.
So, just an observation, which is that because of this weird stuff that we're doing with the rate that's in paragraph 62, that's why I think in 9C it should be called a modified historical cost measurement, not for the reasons we've got in the paper, but because that's as far as I'm concerned, for historical cost measurement.
Okay. All agreed? Yeah. Do we need to vote? No, okay, so it was just not necessary, really. Okay. Then we go back to 9C.
We'd like to discuss now the measurement basis in Agenda Paper 9C, which is covered in paragraphs 30 to 46. And last month we stated it would be more suitable to describe the measurement technique as a modified historical cost measurement basis because it requires an entity to update estimates of cash flows, but it would not update the discount rate established at the initial recognition for market changes, which is a key feature of a current value measurement basis. And at the May 2019, so last month's board meetings, some board members advised the staff to back up a recommendation on the measurement basis being modified historical cost a bit farther. So paragraphs 39 to 46 provide additional reasons for the staff to back up the recommendation to describe the measurement technique as a modified historical cost measurement basis. And that leads us to the question we have after paragraph 46 of the paper, whether the board agrees with the recommendation to describe the measurement technique as a modified historical cost measurement basis.
I do agree, but just I guess a flag of caution here. In paragraph 43, I think that if my memory serves me correctly, that when we did the conceptual framework, and I know it was a difficult discussion, but we landed on amortized cost being a historical cost measurement basis. And under amortized cost, we'd do both of what's in A and B in paragraph 43. We update for ECLs, and if there's a modification to estimated cash flows, we'd modify for those, and we wouldn't call it modified historical cost. I'd still get to modified historical cost, but because of what we're doing with the rate. So I just think we need to be careful not to have something that's contrary to what we've said elsewhere.
That's right.
I had exactly the same comment, plus the fact that I agreed with the why paragraph 25 was written describing demand risk, customer credit risk, and non-performance risk. And I agree that they're described as typically low. And as a result, I think basically what we are doing here is reflecting the regulatory agreement. And the regulatory agreement is what allows to determine, in fact, the transaction price. So to me, it's a fully historical cost measurement. Mm-hmm. I don't need to get into. Otherwise, I think this distracts the reader as if those elements had a more important role to play than they should.
Thank you. I agree with the step recommendation. But I don't think, you know, do you need that phrase modified? I don't think we need to have a modified phrase because as you analyzed in paragraph 35, the conceptual framework, the historical cost-based method, it's just it's typically not the same as you, mm-hmm. Described here. So I guess just the historical cost method is good enough. It's consistent with conceptual framework, so just to delete modified.
Okay.
You modifying that? Vote?
Yeah. Agree?
We'll be voting on.
Modified on
what? Modified.
Taking out modified or not? What do you?
Well, maybe we should ask it as per the question and then. If people would prefer to call it just a straight historical cost, we'll do it both ways. So if we go with modified historical cost, first of all.
Okay. Oh. We'll still get the second question.
Sorry.
I think only if this fails.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Sorry, yeah. Right. Yeah. I think vote once.
Modified now for all.
Vote once and only once. So you can either vote for modified historical cost or just vote for historical cost.
No, I don't think we're doing that. I think we're taking a straight vote on the staff recommendation. If that fails, then you can
Well, it didn't. It was adopted.
Well, let's check. Okay. Let's just check.
As written. Modified.
As written.
These three. 11.
All right.
And We move then to the last section of the paper, which is covered in paragraphs 47 to 54. It is dealing with the measurement of regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities that relate to expenses or income that will be included in or deducted from the future rates when cash is paid or received. And in December, the board narrowly rejected the staff's recommendation that the measurement of the regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities in this category should be carried out by using the same measurement basis that an entity uses when measuring the related liability or related asset. And an entity then would be adjusting the measurement of the regulatory asset or regulatory liability to reflect any risks that are not present in the related items. In May, we clarified that this recommendation represented an exception to the model's measurement principle. And for the reasons given in paragraphs 50 and 52, the staff still hold the recommendation that we made in December. And we are asking the board to reconsider it in the question that we have in paragraph 56 of the paper.
Any comments? Errol?
So I think the changes that the staff have made to the paper regarding this issue over the last couple of months, I think, have made it a lot clearer, and I think it's been good changes because I think they've helped people understand exactly what we're talking about. I think it's absolutely correct to characterize this as an exception from the model. And I think that helps at least me understand exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it. I think it comes then back to a decision which I probably weighed up all the way through the process, which is, are we trying to achieve a particular outcome for this model in isolation from everything else we do in IFRS? So we want to, in some ways, correct for other things that are happening in IFRS and in other places? Or do we want to try and be consistent with other IFRSs in the way that they would deal with the similar situation? Now, I think that becomes a judgment call for each of us to make in terms of how we feel. I still find myself falling back to the consistency with other IFRSs, and that leaves me disagreeing with the staff recommendation, but it's not a massive disagreement from my perspective. I think we need to just be very careful in how we, if we do go down the route of the staff recommendation, we need to be very careful in how we articulate why we're doing this. And I think the discussion that you've had in terms of the usefulness for people who are looking at regulatory accounts, mm-hmm. I think the reservation that I've always had about this one, and I think I've expressed it in the past and I'll express it again, is that if all of these terms and conditions were contained in a single revenue agreement with a customer, I would get different accounting to what we're proposing here, and I found that difficult. So it is where I've come down to, and as I said, I don't necessarily see it as a huge point, but I'm not going to vote in favour of where the staff have landed.
Sorry, can I ask a clarifying question, because I got lost partway through there, apologies. Because you said the question that it raises is, do we want to try and be pure in this model and look at this model in isolation? Or do we want to try and be consistent with the other IFRSs? When you said that, and then I thought I heard you say that you were looking at being consistent with the other IFRSs, which I thought was pushing you towards the staff recommendation.
No, sorry, so when I mean consistent with other IFRSs, consistent with the outcome that you would, for example, get under IFRS 15. So it is that I look at the cash flows I am expecting to receive from the counterparty in isolation of what those cash flows are going to be used to offset. Mm. Does that help a little bit?
I think I'm still struggling with the disconnect in the regulatory agreement for these types of items is saying that when you incur the cash flow in the future, then that's what you can include in the rate. And so I'm struggling to disconnect the two, because that's what the agreement says. So
absolutely.
I don't know today what cash flow I'm going to incur in the future. What I do have is a different standard that tells
Is it useful to actually go with an example we know of? So deferred tax is, I think, the easiest example we've sort of incurred all the way through the process. So I think for me there's two ways I can think about this. I can say that the way that deferred taxes are measured in my balance sheet under IS 12 is not necessarily an economic representation of today's
of today's present value of the future payment. Do I then use this standard to correct for that effect, which is, I think, the staff proposal? So what I would
We're completely the opposite way around. So what we're saying is we're going to accept what IAS 12 says is the
absolutely,
estimate.
I agree.
That's what he's saying.
But what you're essentially saying is you're saying that if I were to apply the model without the exception, I would say the present value of that future cash flow measured at an appropriate discount rate.
Is 84.
Whatever.
Yeah.
IAS 12 is telling me to capture 100. So the exception that you are saying here is what I would do is I would make an exception to the model that says I would recognize 84, and I'd instead recognize 100 now so that I'm recognizing the same.
Yes.
So in other words, I'm making an exception to my recognition model to accommodate a different measurement model elsewhere in IFRSs. Okay. So that's the one approach. The other approach is for me to say, well, what would I have got if I just had a normal revenue contract that also said it would compensate me for the taxes? And what I'm weighing up here is what is more important for me, consistency with IFRS 15, say, or other IFRSs, or this internal consistency in the model? Now, I think there are arguments for both sides. I'm just saying I fall on the consistency with IFRS 15 approach.
So,
I think I'm in the same place as Daryl in two different ways. Firstly, that this analysis helped me a lot compared with last time we discussed it because I finally understood what the point is, which is I'm very slow on this, sorry. Not your fault, my fault. That I completely agree that the model should be capturing the effect on my ability to recover from customers because of my future obligations to pay for pensions or whatever it is, and it should be included in the model. So I completely agree with that. But the model for me is saying that I want to recognise an amount which is, peeking ahead to the presentation and disclosure paper, captured in this line item near revenue that's telling me all of these things that are going on because of these adjustments. I want to capture them all there in that way rather than going the additional step, which is not just saying I want to include the cash flow effects in what I'm doing in this project, but also try and help users of financial statements an extra step by providing a countervailing effect for some of the funny measurement things we've got going on IFRS elsewhere. So I wouldn't go either that extra step. I'd rather just say, yes, include the effects in capturing it as one of the timing differences, but use the normal measurement model to do that.
Mary?
I'm going to echo part but not all of Daryl's comment in the sense of I think this is one where we have to give the views, you know, the logic behind each, and people will weigh up things differently. I think in this instance, I too am right at the margin, but I probably fall on the side of the staff recommendation. However, I think the other thing that we haven't done yet, I don't think we need another paper here, but I think we need in our consultation document to spell out how this operationalizes in terms of not day one, but you know year three and year five, and not in excruciating detail. But what I mean is, if you have the tax example, assuming that you're tax whiz of the Western world and you never have to remeasure that 100 because that's what it is. You got it exactly right on day one. But so there's no change in the period between that and when the cash is paid out. But for other things, the IFRS measure will have, let's say, decommissioning accretion of the interest on the obligation. And then when we get to pensions, we'll have the more complex of some of the cost may be recognized in comprehensive income, not P&L. I'm not talking about the presentation. So I think just saying that you measure it based on the IFRS measure is not sufficient guidance. We have to talk about how, you know, if we go the staff recommendation route, how you get from the initial measurement to the ultimate cash outflow and whether that flows through as regulatory income, regulatory expense. And some of it we touch on the presentation paper, but I think it's the more fundamental mechanics here.
Well, I think one of the main objectives in this project is to ensure that the profit or loss is with a good reflection of the regulatory agreement effect. So if we leave in the process differences some form of mismatch. But I understand the proposal of the staff is meant to eliminate.
Yes.
I think we're just departing from the objective of the project. And by the way, the conceptual framework does not make the promotion of OCI, but certainly indicates that they should be used in order to avoid the effect of mismatches. So
I think if I can maybe just, Francoise, pick up on the point. The OCI issue, I think it's related, but it's quite a separate issue. So focus here is on the measurement. And what we're looking at here is trying to get, we've got two related cash flows that are directly related through the regulatory agreement. And what the staff recommendation is trying to get to is avoiding a mismatch. And the conceptual framework does say that, you know, creating measurement mismatches in particular may not give a faithful representation or may not give relevant information. So that's part of the driver for our recommendation. Another driver is the complexity of the model. So these companies that are applying already have to calculate these numbers based on IS 12, IS 37, these other standards that are dictating how they come up with a measurement for the related cash flow. And what we're trying to say is, well, why impose a second calculation for the same cash flows? And in particular, just the practicalities of some of these. You know, why does IAS 12 say do not discount the deferred tax? It's partly because it's just too complicated to try and calculate that, because the base number we're using is partially discounted already. We need to think about the timing of those cash flows, et cetera, and then come up with a suitable rate. So if it's too difficult to do it for the tax number, how can we say it's not too difficult to do it for the related cash flow for the reimbursement of that tax number? So there's practicality issues, there's the conceptual framework driving the staff recommendation. And I have to confess, I'm struggling with how entities would cope with coming up with the calculation in some of these cases, particularly for deferred tax.
Okay, Tom?
I think, especially listening to Jane, I'm sympathetic, but I think Daryl's got it right. I'm kind of on an edge. But I have another thing I just want to make sure doesn't cause grief in this. Most of your examples are long-lived ones, and the regulatory agreements are often short, at least with respect to very specific rates. And so they may say, there may be expectation as they roll over that something like your decommissioning cost 30 years from now will be allowed, but they probably haven't given you a right, at least the way we define the asset so far. So when we go through this, does the fact that we may be dealing with little chunks, like a chunk of the pension because it's, you know, whatever, being paid over 30 years or something, like how much are they actually giving you a right to put in a rate over the agreement that is sufficiently strong that we can create these assets and liabilities?
I think we've said that next month we're going to try and come back and deal specifically with those scenarios where there is a shorter term cutoff and there's a renewal process to go through. But I think, you know, a lot of these agreements that we're looking for, the company would have to do something to breach its terms and conditions in order to have the cutoff. So I appreciate the point, Tom, that we do need to think about renewals and what happens if the time for the reversal is beyond the time of reversal. But I don't think it should detract us from
My question is, because if in the complete world you're giving us, I kind of understand it's simpler to say it's, you know, 100 and 100. But here you're going to have to figure out what, if we decide that we're going to limit it to, say, a shorter period, then you're going to have to take that 100 and say what portion of it is legitimate for the next 3 years. And that's what I'm just saying, is that this idea that it is simpler may not be simple, if depending what we do with that issue.
I mean, I think there's a couple of things here. One is in paragraph 54, and again, this we brought out in more detail in the December paper, is that if we then have these additional risks or the curtailment of how far forward we can take the recovery, that would be an adjustment to the regulatory asset or regulatory liability measurement. But what we're asking for here in this staff recommendation is that at least the starting point is the same measurement basis as the thing that it's directly related to. And then as a separate exercise, we start thinking about, well, if it's going to take 10 years to recover and we've only got an agreement that we can look 5 years ahead to, what's the reversal in that 5 years?
Dean, might it make sense to just take Tom's as a potential sweep issue, depending upon how the discussion of next month's paper goes? And then once we discuss next month's paper, see if the decision in that trips any reconsideration of this? Just put it that way.
Do we still need a vote?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. What are we voting on?
Of recommendation.
Question three.
Recommendation to follow the measurement basis.
11.
Okay, I suggest...
Four? Huh?
Yes. I suggest we take a break, because unless it could be guaranteed that the next paper would be decided in 5 minutes, and I don't think that can be guaranteed. So we break until 1:45.
Thank you.